We will now have a relatively short introduction to a work which bears only slightly on the material we are studying, but which deserves to be looked at because of its great importance and its continuing use, especially in the Eastern Church. And that's his treatise on the priesthood by St. John Chrysostom. John Chrysostom, as we'll recall, is in the next generation after the Cappadocian fathers Basil, Gregory Nazianzen, and Gregory of Nyssa. John Chrysostom lives from about 347 to 407. He is Bishop of Constantinople, Patriarch of Constantinople, beginning in the year 398. And he is a fearless preacher, and because of his preaching against vice, he is particularly despised by the Empress Eudoxia, who presumes, perhaps rightly, that some of his sermons against people who overdress and who are flaunting their wealth and riches too much, that some of his sermons were actually aimed at her. And as a result of this enmity that he receives in court, he was condemned at the Synod of the Oak in the year 403 and then banished. And although he was recalled, he ended up in exile, first in Antioch and then in Pontus. And so he died in exile, and it belonged to the next generation of emperors to bring his body back with festal rejoicing and a certain amount of apology to the city of Constantinople. He was a brilliant preacher, and his homilies are for the East what the homilies of St. Augustine are for the West. They continue to be read and studied as masterpieces of exegesis, especially allegorical exegesis, and also of the application of gospel principles to people's lives. He's a representative of the clerical tradition that seeks to offer spiritual guidance through homilies, and we'll see this regularly as we continue and as we conclude our course. Episcopal authors for whom spiritual guidance is primarily not a one-to-one phenomenon, but is something that is offered from the pulpit. And here we need to bear in mind that in his treatise on the priesthood, the title itself is slightly ambiguous for the simple reason that it really is only towards the end of the 4th century, toward the end of the 300s and beginning of the 400s, that the word priest, Hierus in Greek and sacerdos in Latin, begins to be applied to what we would today in the Roman Catholic or the Orthodox tradition call a priest. The threefold division of bishop, priest, and deacon is of very great antiquity. It can be traced back to the last decades of already in the first century, and certainly is widespread by the second century. But the term priest, Hierus or sacerdos, is exclusively reserved for the bishop during the first three centuries of the church's history and into the fourth century as well. It is the bishop who is solely responsible for the ministry of preaching and of presiding at the altar. The bishop can and very frequently does delegate this responsibility to the presbyteros, to the elder, and eventually the term presbyter becomes synonymous with our idea of priest, but it does not mean and it should not be translated as priest in the earliest centuries. So John Chrysostom is writing on the priesthood, by which he means all the responsibilities, particularly that the bishop exercises, but which the bishop may in fact delegate, and often does delegate, to presbyters as well. So primary focus of his treatise will be on the responsibility which bishops have in the form of guidance and direction that bishops offer in the context of preaching. Although again, this responsibility is delegated. Now, this of course is the theology that was recovered in the Roman Catholic Church, especially prior to and then during the Second Vatican Council, and which is particularly expressed in the concelebrated liturgy, where the bishop is the principal celebrant and the presbyters of the diocese surround the bishop and assist in this, particularly in the chrism mass at cathedrals every year. This is a reminder of this ancient and modern ecclesiology in which the bishop alone has the fullness of the priesthood, and which the presbyters participate in and receive, as it were, a delegation to preside in the bishop's stead in local places, although since the 5th and 6th centuries in particular, theologically it's regarded that the presbyter has the right to do this in his own right, but only insofar as he has a mandate from, as he is a part of an incarnated participant in a diocese or has an ordinary. So, Chrysostom is writing on the priesthood, and the material that we'll be looking at is concerned only in one section with the subject at hand, which is to say offering spiritual guidance. And I've chosen some relatively brief selections from book two of this treatise, and we'll see that it takes the form, you can see in 2.1, of a classical dialogue between Basil and Chrysostom. And this is not Basil the Great, but it is it's a figure whom Chrysostom uses in this dialogical form to ask questions, which he can then answer. And this is a very traditional way of doing theology. Gregory the Great uses it in his dialogues, as we'll see when we look at the story of Benedict and Scholastica and Benedict and the Tower Window. This ancient, dating back to the time of Plato and Aristotle, model of doing theology, doing philosophy, allows a question-answer approach. And here he is talking about, he initially talks in a kind of a joking, playful way about the notion of deception, or pretending something that is the case, which turns out not to be, as a way of introducing the subject of, in 2.2, the idea of the priest as one who is responsible for tending the sheep of God. Now, again, this treatise is primarily for those who have clerical responsibility, pastoral responsibility for a liturgical assembly, and for one, as it were, gathered around the bishop. But one can take principles contained here and recognize that they represent the application in the context of diocesan ministry of something which had already been developed and practiced within the monastic context, as we've seen. Chrysostom himself lived as an ascetic, lived as a hermit before his ordination, before being called into priestly and then episcopal ministry. And so his model and his traditions are adaptations, much as we've already seen in Basil and to some extent in Gregory of Nazianzen, of traditions that existed in the Christian desert among monastics who were concerned with the spiritual guidance offered by an Abba or an Amma to a disciple. This is an application of this tradition in a broader way by people who already, of course, have a centuries-old approach based on Christ's invitation and command to tend the sheep of God, but which is now being renewed and invigorated by a kind of an influx of ideas from the Egyptian desert. And Chrysostom himself is one of those who, as it were, institutionalizes this in this textbook, which does indeed become a textbook for those who were to undertake a priestly ministry. Now we're going to have to drop down quite a bit to number 2.3, the section that I've highlighted or given a dark bar of, that's entitled Shepherd of Souls. This we've already seen is something that Gregory Nazianzen in his second oration particularly emphasizes, that one who offers pastoral assistance, who provides spiritual guidance, is undertaking the responsibility of being a shepherd, a pastor of souls, and indeed a physician of souls as well. And here Chrysostom asks in number 2.3 the question, how can anyone apply a remedy for a disease of which he does not know the character? This is a reminder of the fact that one has to understand what one might call spiritual pathology. One has to be aware of the ways in which the human soul, the human heart, goes wrong in order to have a sense of the remedies that are correct for this. Now, again, the remedy will always be the presence of God, the use of the means of grace, prayer, the traditional ascetical disciplines, and regular participation in the sacramental life of the Church. Those will always be the remedies, but how can one apply the remedy in a way that will be heard and accepted by the one to whom one is speaking, by the one who is injured and who is seeking help? Well, he points out in the next paragraph, where I've also given a dark bar, that free consent and cooperation is required for healing among Christians. And this is a theme that we will also see in the writings and in the actual practice of Ambrose of Milan, that the unique thing, and in many ways the difficulty, the impediment of the person who is offering spiritual counsel and advice, who seeks to be a spiritual guide, is different from the model of the prophet, who can stand up and loudly proclaim, simply condemn, and then walk away. That is to say, to say the word of the God, of the Lord, and then presume that it's going to sink into the hearts of hearers. And indeed, of course, if one has the charism of a prophet, one can presume that God is giving the skills to enable that to be heard. But Chrysostom's point And the point that we'll see in Ambrose is that the one who is involved in Christian spiritual guidance must respect and be aware of the fact that the other must freely give consent for healing or it won't work. And in the highlighted text he says, the reception of the treatment depends on the will of the patient, not the will of the one who applies the remedy. So it's not enough to be right. It's not enough to know what the remedy is. One must be able to, with the power and the assistance of the Spirit of God, to encourage the cooperation and free will of the one to whom one ministers. He says, Christians above all are not permitted to forcibly correct the failings of those who sin. Now, he's speaking slightly polemically here. He's not speaking about the fact that Christians may not influence public policy. That's a different question, and we'll see that to some extent in Ambrose's approach to Theodosius the Emperor. But Christians in general must invite cooperation and respect free will as God himself does. In our case, he says, the wrongdoer must be made better not by force, but by persuasion. And so he says, consequently, much skill is required that our patients may be induced to submit willingly to the treatment prescribed by the, as it were, spiritual physicians. For it is not possible for anyone to cure someone by compulsion against their will. He has already used the example, and the example is sort of widespread, that if a medical cure works, you could theoretically tie a person down and force them to submit to it, but that will not work for the spiritual cure which the spiritual guide, the spiritual director, the Amma, the Abba is offering. In order for it to work, it depends upon the free will, the acceptance by the one to whom it is being offered. And this is, of course, Christian sacramental theology as well. Sacraments, particularly the sacraments of holy orders, the sacrament of matrimony, do not work unless the one receiving the sacrament intends to receive it and is rightly disposed. So there is a profound love of and respect for the other that requires a very great willingness to look at the other, to recognize their weaknesses, their limitations, and to craft and shape what one offers to that particular person's nature. And number 2.4, we ought not, in applying punishment, merely to proportion it to the scale of the offense. It's not the question among Christians, or strictly speaking, in pastoral moral theology, in spiritual guidance, simply to decide how grave is this sin, how grave should be the punishment, but rather, he says, to keep in view the disposition of the sinner. Now, this is not in order to excuse the sin, or to pretend that there is no sin, or to basically absolve oneself from any need to do anything, but on the contrary, to make one aware of the fact that you may, if your punishment is too great, while you intend to mend, as he puts it, what is torn, you may make the rent worse. And in your zealous endeavors to restore what has fallen, you may make the ruin of the individual greater. So, by preaching harshly to one who has sinned and only driving them further away from the church, you make the ruin greater, and the implication is, and you are responsible for the deeper ruin of that individual. So the task of preaching and of offering advice is a very delicate and sensitive one, and has to be entered into with the greatest respect and awe for the God who, above all, appreciates human freedom. Then the highlighted text that comes after that, the shepherd has much need of wisdom to observe on every side the Greek word is hexis, of the soul, the disposition, the quality, the nature of its tendency towards sin and towards virtue. The disposition of the individual will very much require an adjustment on the part of the person who is offering advice in this context. And remember, he's speaking about a bishop who is preaching. So this advice, which seems so clearly applicable to the one-to-one context, is something that Chrysostom is also saying should be offered in the context of one's pastoral ministry in preaching the word as well. Again, it does not mean fearing to speak the truth. It does not mean avoiding difficult issues, but recognizing that when the issue is difficult and the pattern of sinning is hardened or repetitive, one must be very careful, and as he put it in the very beginning, almost even devious in raising this question so that the other can, in some sense, hear it. It requires, as he puts it, much wisdom, much sunesis, to use one of the Greek words for wisdom. It behooves the priest, therefore, to leave none of the things unexamined, but after a thorough inquiry into all of them, to apply such remedies as he has appositely determined to be appropriate in each case, lest his zeal prove to be in vain. And so the other thing that, of course, one has to have, if you drop down to the last sections that are highlighted here, one ought never to be despondent or to despair of the salvation of wanderers from the fold. The fact that someone doesn't listen, the fact that someone is continuing to engage in practices that are destructive of them or are overtly sinful, that are carrying them away from God and the church, one does not despair, but trusts that God has a plan for that individual and seeks to be open to possibilities in the future where it might be possible to say something to that individual. Rightly, therefore, did the Lord say that zeal for the flock was a token of love for himself. Real concern for the other is a characteristic of Christ. So, a very beautiful depiction of the necessity for sensitivity to the unique qualities of each to whom one ministers, and of a profound sense of the need for a respect for human freedom and the necessity for cooperating with the Spirit of God rather than simply jumping in, claiming that one has either preached the word or told the person what is right and imagining that that will suffice. On the contrary, according to Chrysostom, if that is done without sensitivity to the other, one may be responsible for the ruin of a soul and therefore answerable to God for the destruction one has caused.